Chapter 5. Children issued forth in arms, and this scene the artist has immortalized. We have spoken of the admirable way in which Mr. Cruikshank has depicted Irish character and Cockney character. English country character is quite as faithfully delineated in the person of the stout porteress and her children, and of the hobbiton with the shovel, on whose face is written Amersetshire. Chobbiton appears in another plate, or else Chobbiton's brother. He has come up to London, and is looking about the madrasas. How distinct are these rustics from those whom we have just been examining? They hang about the purlieus of the metropolis. Brook Green, Epsom, Greenwich, Ascot, Goodwood, are their haunts. They visit London professionally once a year, and that is at the time of Bartholomew Fair. How one may speculate upon the different degrees of rascality, as exhibited in each face of the Thimblerigging trio, and form little histories for these worthies, charming Newgate romances, such as have been of late the fashion. Is any man so blind, that he cannot see the exact face, that is writhing under the Thimblerigged hero's hat? Like Timonth's of old, our artist expresses great passions without the aid of the human countenance. There is another specimen, a street row of inebriated bottles. Is there any need of having a face after this? Oh man, says Claret Bottle, a dashing, genteel fellow, with his hat on one ear. Oh man, has any man a mind to tap me? Claret Bottle is a little screwed, as one may see by his legs, but full of gaiety and courage. Not so that stout, apoplectic bottle of rum, who has staggered against the wall, and has his hand upon his liver. The fellow hurts himself with smoking, that is clear, and is as sick can be. See, port is making away from the storm, and double X is as flat as ditch water. Against these, awful in their white robes, the sober watchmen come. Our artist then can cover up faces, and yet show them quite clearly, as in the Thimblerig group, or he can do without faces altogether, or he can, at a pinch, provide a countenance for a gentleman out of any given object, a beautiful Irish physiognomy being molded upon a keg of whiskey, and a jolly English countenance frothing out of a pot of ale. The spirit of brave Toby Philpot come back to reanimate his clay, while in a fungus may be recognized the physiognomy of a mushroom peer. Finally, if he is at a loss, he can make a living head, body, and legs out of steel or tortoise shell, as in the case of the vivacious pair of spectacles that are jockeying the nose of Caddy Cuddle. Of late years Mr. Cruikshank has busied himself very much with steel engraving, and the consequences of that lucky invention have been that his plates are now sold by thousands, where they could only be produced by hundreds before. He has made many a bookseller's and author's fortune.
We trust that in so doing he may not have neglected his own
12 admirable plates, furnished yearly to that facetious little publication, the Comic Almanac, have gained for it a sale, as we hear, of nearly 20,000 copies. The idea of the work was novel. There was, in the first number especially, a great deal of comic power, and Cruikshank's designs were so admirable that the almanac at once became a vast favorite with the public, and has so remained ever since. Besides the 12 plates, this almanac contains a prophetic woodcut, accompanying an awful Blarneyham Astrologicum, that appears in this and other almanacs. There is one that hints in pretty clear terms that with the reform of municipal corporations the ruin of the great Lord Mayor of London is at hand. His lordship is meekly going to dine at an eightpenny ordinary, his giants in pawn, his men in armor dwindled to knee poor knight, his carriage to be sold, his stalwart aldermen vanished, his sheriffs, alas, and alas, in gaol. Another design shows that Rigdom, if a true, is also a moral and instructive prophet. John Bull is asleep, or rather in a vision, the cunning demon, speculation, blowing a thousand bright bubbles about him. Meanwhile the rooks are busy at his fob, a knave has cut a cruel hole in his pocket, a rattlesnake has coiled safe round his feet, and will in a trice swallow bull, share, money and all. The rats are at his corn bags, as if,
Poor devil, he had corn to spare. His faithful dog is bolting his leg of mutton. Nay, a thief has gotten hold of his very candle, and there, by way of moral, is his ale pot, which looks and winks in his face, and seems to say, O bull, all this is froth. And a cruel satirical picture of a certain rustic who had a goose, that laid certain golden eggs, which goose the rustic slew in expectation of finding all the eggs at once. This is Goose and Sage too, to borrow the pun of earned Dr. Gill, but we shrewdly suspect that Mr. Cruikshank is becoming a little conservative in his notions. We love these pictures, so that it is hard to part us, and we still fondly endeavor to hold on, but this wild word, farewell, must be spoken by the best friends at last, and so goodbye, brave woodcuts. We feel quite a sadness in coming to the last of our collection. In the earlier numbers of the Comic Almanac, all the manners and customs of Londoners that would afford food for fun were noted down. And if during the last 2 years the mysterious personage who, under the title of Ignam Finitos, compiles this ephemeris, has been compelled to resort to romantic tales, we must suppose that he did so because the great metropolis was exhausted, and it was necessary to discover new worlds in the cloudland of fancy. The character of Mr. Stubbs, who made his appearance in the Almanac for 1839, had, we think, great merit, although his adventures were somewhat of too tragical a description to provoke pure laughter. We should be glad to devote a few pages to the lustratons of time, the craps and sketches, and the lustrations of phrenology, which are among the most famous of our artist's publications. But it is very difficult to find new terms of praise, as find them one must, when reviewing Mr. Cruikshank's publications, and more difficult still, as the reader of this notice will no doubt have perceived for himself long since, to translate his design into words, and go to the printer's box for a description of all that fun and humor which the artist can produce by a few skillful turns of his needle. A famous article upon the illustrations of time appeared some dozen years since in Blackwood's magazine, of which the conductors have always been great admirers of our artist, as became men of honor and genius. To these grand qualities do not let it be supposed that we are laying claim, but, thank heaven, Cruikshank's humor is so good and benevolent that any man must love it, and on this score we may speak as well as another. Then there are the Rienwich Hospital designs, which must not be passed over. Rienwich Hospital is a hearty, good-natured book, in the Tom Dibden school, treating of the virtues of British tars, in approved nautical language. They maul Frenchmen and Spaniards, they go out in brigs and take frigates, they relieve women in distress, and are yardarm and yardarming, athwart-tossing, marlinspiking, binnacling, and helms a leeing, as honest seamen invariably do, in novels, on the stage, and doubtless on board ship. This we cannot take upon us to say, but the artist, like a true Englishman, as he is, loves dearly these brave guardians of old England, and chronicles their rare or fanciful exploits with the greatest goodwill. Let anyone look at the noble head of Nelson in the Amelie Library, and they will, we are sure, think with us that the designer must have felt and loved what he drew. There are to this abridgment of Southey's admirable book many more cuts after Cruikshank, and about a dozen pieces by the same hand will be found in a work equally popular, Lockhart's excellent Life of Napoleon. Among these, the retreat from Moscow is very fine. The Mamluks most vigorous, furious, and barbarous, as they should be. At the end of these three volumes, Mr. Cruikshank's contributions to the Amelie Library seem suddenly to have ceased. We are not at all disposed to undervalue the works and genius of Mr. Dickens, and we are sure that he would admit as readily as any man the wonderful assistance that he has derived from the artist who has given us the portraits of his ideal personages, and made them familiar to all the world. Once seen, these figures remain impressed on the memory, which otherwise would have had no hold upon them, and the heroes and heroines of Boz become personal acquaintances with each of us. Oh, that Hogarth could have illustrated Fielding in the same way, and fixed down on paper those grand figures of Parson Adams, and Squire Allworthy, and the great Jonathan Wilde. With regard to the modern romance of Jack Sheppard, in which the latter personage makes a second appearance, it seems to us that Mr. Cruikshank really created the tale, and that Mr. Ainsworth, as it were, only put words to it. Let any reader of the novel think over it for a while, now that it is some months since he has perused, and laid it down, let him think, and tell us what he remembers of the tale. George Cruikshank's pictures always George Cruikshank's pictures. The storm in the Thames, for instance. All the author's labored description of that event has passed clean away. We have only before the mind's eye the fine plates of Cruikshank. The poor wretch cowering under the bridge arch, as the waves come rushing in, and the boats are whirling away in the drift of the great swollen black waters. And let any man look at that second plate of the murder on the Thames, and he must acknowledge how much more brilliant the artist's description is than the writer's, and what a real genius for the terrible as well as for the ridiculous the former has. How awful is the gloom of the old bridge, a few lights glimmering from the houses here and there, but not so as to be reflected on the water at all, which is too turbid and raging. A great heavy rack of clouds goes sweeping over the bridge, and men with flaring torches, the murderers, are borne away with the stream. The author requires many pages to describe the fury of the storm, which Mr. Cruikshank has represented in one. First, he has to prepare you with the something inexpressibly melancholy in sailing on a dark night upon the Thames, colon the ripple of the water, the darkling current, the indistinctively seen craft, comma the solemn shadows, and other phenomena visible on rivers at night, are detailed with not unskillful rhetoric, in order to bring the reader into a proper frame of mind for the deeper gloom and horror which is to ensue. Then follow pages of description. S. Roland sprang to the helm, and gave the signal for pursuit. A warlike a volley of ordnance was heard aloft, and the wind again burst its bondage. A moment before the surface of the stream was as black as ink. It was now whitening, hissing, and seething, like an enormous cauldron. The blast once more swept over the agitated river, whirled off the sheets of foam, scattered them far and wide in raindrops, and left the raging torrent blacker than before. Destruction everywhere marked the course of the gale. Steeples toppled and towers reeled beneath its fury. All was darkness, horror, confusion, ruin. Men fled from their tottering habitations and returned to them, scared by greater danger. The end of the world seemed at hand. The hurricane had now reached its climax. The blast shrieked, as if exulting in its wrathful mission. Stunning and continuous, the din seemed almost to take away the power of hearing. He who had faced the gale would have been instantly stifled, and see. See with what a tremendous war of words and good loud words too. Mr. Ainsworth's description is a good and spirited one. The author is obliged to pour in upon the reader before he can effect his purpose upon the latter and inspire him with a proper terror. The painter does it at a glance, and old Wood's dilemma in the midst of that tremendous storm, with the little infant at his bosom, is remembered afterwards, not from the words, but from the visible image of them that the artist has left us. It would not, perhaps, be out of place to glance through the whole of the Jack Sheppard plates, which are among the most finished and the most successful of Mr. Cruikshank's performances, and say a word or two concerning them. Let us begin with finding fault with number 1. Mr. Wood offers to adopt little Jack Sheppard. A poor print, on a poor subject. The figure of the woman not as carefully designed as it might be, and the expression of the eyes not an uncommon fault with our artist, much caricatured. The print is cut up, to use the artist's phrase, by the number of accessories which the engraver has thought proper, after the author's elaborate description, elaborately to reproduce. The plate of ill-discovering Daryl in the loft is admirable, ghastly, terrible, and the treatment of it extraordinarily skillful, minute, and bold. The intricacies of the tile work, and the mysterious twinkling of light among the beams, are excellently felt and rendered. And one sees here, as in the two next plates of The Storm and Murder, what a fine eye the artist has, what a skillful hand, and what a sympathy for the wild and dreadful. As a mere imitation of nature, the clouds and the bridge in the murder picture may be examined by painters who make far higher pretensions than Mr. Cruikshank. In point of workmanship they are equally good, the manner quite unaffected, the effect produced without any violent contrast, the whole scene evidently well and philosophically arranged in the artist's brain, before he began to put it upon copper. The famous drawing of Act carving the name on the beam, which has been transferred to half the playbills in town, is overloaded with accessories, as the first plate, but they are much better arranged than in the last-named engraving, and do not injure the effect of the principal figure. Remark 2, the conscientiousness of the artist, and that shrewd pervading idea of form which is one of his principal characteristics. Jack is surrounded by all sorts of implements of his profession. He stands on a regular carpenter's table. Away in the shadow under it lie shavings, and a couple of carpenter's hampers. The glue pot, the mallet, the chisel handle, the planes, the saws, the hone with its cover, and the other paraphernalia are all represented with extraordinary accuracy and forethought. The man's mind has retained the exact drawing of all these minute objects, unconsciously perhaps to himself, but we can see with what keen eyes he must go through the world, and what a fund of facts, as such a knowledge of the shape of objects is in his profession, this keen student of nature has stored away in his brain. In the next plate, where Jack is escaping from his mistress, the figure of that lady, one of the deepest of the Greek text omitted, strikes us as disagreeable and unrefined. That of Winifred is, on the contrary, very pretty and graceful, and Jack's puzzled, slinking look must not be forgotten. All the accessories are good, and the apartment has a snug, cozy air, which is not remarkable, except that it shows how faithfully the designer has performed his work, and how curiously he has entered into all the particulars of the subject. Master Thames Darrell, the handsome young man of the book, is, in Mr. Cruikshank's portraits of him, no favorite of ours. The lad seems to wish to make up for the natural insignificance of his face, by frowning on all occasions most portentously. This figure, borrowed from the compositor's desk, will give a notion of what we mean. Wilde's face is too violent for the great man of history, if we may call Fielding history, but this is in consonance with the ranting, frowning, braggadocious character that Mr. Ainsworth has given him. The interior of Willesden Church is excellent as a composition, and a piece of artistical workmanship. The groups are well arranged. And the figure of Mrs. Shepherd looking round alarmed, as her son is robbing the dandy kneebone, is charming, simple, and unaffected. Not so Mrs. Shepherd ill in bed, whose face is screwed up to an expression vastly too tragic. The little glimpse of the church seen through the open door of the room is very beautiful and poetical. It is in such small hints that an artist especially excels. They are the morals which he loves to append to his stories, and are always appropriate and welcome. The boozing ken is not to our liking. Mrs. Shepherd is there with her horrified eyebrows again. Why this exaggeration is it necessary for the public? We think not, or if they require such excitement, let our artist, like a true painter as he is, teach them better things. Asterisk, 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 a gentleman whose wit is so celebrated that one should be very cautious in repeating his stories, gave the writer a good illustration of the philosophy of exaggeration. Mister was once behind the scenes at the opera, when the scene shifters were preparing for the ballet. Flora was to sleep under a bush, whereon were growing a number of roses, and amidst which was fluttering a gay covey of butterflies. In size the roses exceeded the most expansive sunflowers, and the butterflies were as large as cocked hats. The scene shifter explained to Mr., who asked the reason, why everything was so magnified, that the galleries could never see the objects unless they were enormously exaggerated. How many of our writers and designers work for the galleries? The escape from Willesden Cage is excellent. The burglary in Wood's house has not less merit. Mrs. Shepherd in Bedlam, a ghastly picture indeed, is finely conceived, but not, as we fancy, so carefully executed. It would be better for a little more careful Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.